Just do me a little check before we start, will you? You haven't got anything on for the next 40 minutes, have you? Hope not, because you're going to be riveted by this story. I'm Jonathan Overend. Welcome to Sport and the Feels. We're here in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. And for this first series, we're concentrating on the Olympic Games. You'll get a new episode for every day of full competition at the postponed Tokyo 2020 Games. Make sure you subscribe now if you haven't already. Now, we're going to call this episode The Journey. I suppose if you think of any story, any work of fiction, a movie, it's about where you start, where the characters come from. It's about absolutely where they end, what happens at the end of the book or the film. But most intriguingly, it's about what happens in the middle, isn't it? It's about the twists and turns. It's about the ups and downs. It's about the journey. And this, what you're about to hear, I think, is one of the great sports stories of recent years. And the man who's going to tell it is the man who was at the very heart of it. Before we hear from him, though, let's say hello to my co-host, who is Sonia McLaughlin.
Hello,
how are you?
Hello, I'm well, thank you very much.
And you were there, weren't you, in Rio 2016. At the end of this story, we're talking about the Fiji Rugby Union Sevens side, who ended up winning their nation's first ever Olympic medal.
It was one of those moments where there was a real excitement in the rugby fraternity, because this was going to be a fantastic opportunity outside of a Rugby World Cup or a Lions tour to really showcase what rugby is all about. We're going to have both men and women competing in Rio, and the tournament itself exceeded expectations in terms of how brilliant it was. And it ended, in terms of the men's tournament, with this fantastic conclusion, with the wonderful Fiji and all their innate ability winning the Olympic gold medal. It was a wonderful story.
So we've got this incredible nation of Fiji, known for their natural flair and passion for rugby, if not necessarily for their organisational or operational ability at rugby. But then this guy, Ben Ryan, appears, an English coach. He's suddenly there in Fiji, trying to sort this lot out, trying to make a team of them, trying to find some way of getting them on the right pathway for Rio 2016. Before we hear his story, who is he, Sonia? Tell us a bit about him for those who aren't aware.
First and foremost, Ben Ryan is a visionary. He's extremely bright. He's really clever. He was coach of the England team for quite some time. You know, he took very successful with England. They won a Commonwealth silver medal in Melbourne. They did really well on the World Sevens circuit. But he had a fractious relationship with the hierarchy at the Rugby Football Union. And that basically, he was pushed aside. For Ben to be coaching Fiji, it was a natural fit, if you like, with this very clever, forward-thinking, blue-sky thinking individual who had just a natural empathy with Fiji, with the athletes. It was the perfect fit between Ben Ryan and Fiji. And as we saw, it culminated in an incredible moment for him, for the players, for the country, who had never won an Olympic medal of any colour, never mind a gold. And it all coincided and came to fruition with this wonderful moment in Rio.
Let's bring him in then, because he's got quite a story to tell. It's great to have him on the pod. It's gold medal winning coach from 2016, Ben Ryan. Hello, Ben. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks.
Hello, Ben.
Hey, Sonia.
Sonia followed your every step of your journey to gold out in Rio. It must have been a thrilling ride, Sonia, for you as well as for Ben.
Well, you just have a nose for a story. You just knew that this was going to be a story that was ultimately worthy of a movie, because there you had this, you know, Ben won't mind me saying this, bespeckled, red-headed Englishman going to somewhere exotic like rugby-mad Fiji, It was some story. Have I made you blush yet, Ben?
Well, as a ginger, I mean, I only got to step outside these days and I'll go red. So, no, you know, as you alluded to, you know, the Fijians play a wonderful brand of rugby, and they had gone through a pretty poor time, really, for them the last sort of 20, 30 years, with the occasional high point. And so the 3 years I had with Fiji was kind of, you know, there was lots I had to do, but I knew I had the talent, the raw talent. And that's, it's an amazing, if you're going to have one thing that as a coach at your fingertips, it's going to, talent will be your number one choice. And then to see them put it all together in a final, when, you know, I've been coaching teams where often you get to the final and there's nothing left in the tank. You know, the ideal scenario as a coach is to leave your best game to last, and we managed to do that in Rio.
I guess the story really was all about the journey, wasn't it, really? Sort of where the team had come from, and we'll retrace the steps in a few moments' time. But I just wonder, Ben, from your personal point of view, obviously you'll be forever remembered for your achievements in Rio, but what are your other Olympic connections? Was it purely only as a viewer prior to that?
Yeah, I mean, my dad talked a lot about it. He had been to the 48 and 52 Olympic Games in the athlete's village because he had just missed out on selection, and he was in that. And we talked a lot about it. At London Olympic Games, I went to a competition every day. I managed to have a bit of time in the village because that was potentially, I was going to be coaching the GB team in Rio. I'm fanatical about the Olympics, you know, taught it as a PE teacher as well, about the history of it from the Coubertin and the ancient games and everything else. And it's just an amazing, amazing thing to be involved in. So to have rugby in when that got the vote was a pretty special day. Yeah.
And so the first games you would have remembered then as a kid, you know, wide-eyed watching the TV, what would that
be? Yeah, 1980, Moscow Olympics, and Alan Wells, you know, winning that 100 metres, beating the Cuban in the final, and it was literally by his vest.
Cohen Ovett,
and you know, and Co was the first guy I saw running live at the old Borough Road track in West London. We used to go and watch West London run against people like Loughborough, and we went on school holidays. We'd go to things like the European Athletics Championships in Stuttgart, so as a family, kind of athletics in particular was something that we kind of drew towards more than perhaps rugby.
Because actually, when the rugby was finished in Rio, wasn't it, you spent every day at track and field. You're like a kid in a sweet shop, weren't you?
100%, yeah. I was there for Usain's gold medal, for the 400 metres, Van Niekerk's, Wade Van Niekerk's broke the world record there. And actually, he became good mates with our Fijian Sevens captain, Osea Kalinasau. And he hang out with the team quite a lot after his events as well. I loved it. I was grabbing every event I could.
It's funny, Sonia, we were talking about iconic Olympic moments, weren't we, earlier in the series. You don't want to say you'd forgotten about that, but I mean, we sometimes shouldn't forget how significant that world record was, Van Niekerk, that night.
It was just stunning, wasn't it, Ben? I mean, it was jaw-dropping.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I literally remember that it happening because he's running in lane eight and thinking, oh, he's just got out early. And then when he won, and I turned around and looked at the scoreboard and the time, I just thought, well, that's obviously wrong. it just didn't work out. It just didn't, any of it make sense. And that seemed to be the general feeling in the stadium. No one really knew what had happened and whether we'd actually witnessed something that was as big and as good as it really was.
Where on earth, Sonia, are we going to start with Ben on the story of the Fiji rugby sevens team at the Rio 2016 Olympics?
I think I know where to start. I think I know where to start because Ben and I live near each other, and I could almost wave actually from here. And we often bump into each other in local parks when I'm walking my dog, and in our local coffee shop where we frequent the same coffee shop.
Zoran's.
So Ben loves coffee and has a very good taste. And we know this area very well. And I, having read Ben's book, know where it almost started for you, Ben. And that is in an Italian restaurant in Richmond. In one of the, where you came out of the restaurant to take a phone call from the Fijian Rugby Union, and you were just, you left the restaurant and you were standing in one of the kind of well-known lanes in Richmond. And is it right, you basically had 20 minutes to decide whether or not you were going to take up this opportunity or not. Can you take us into that lane in Richmond in that moment?
Sure. And it was just coming into the end of summer, so most people were still out and about, and it was a light evening, and I'd got a phone call that was a +679 number, so I knew it was from Fiji, and I'd had the interview a few weeks earlier on Skype, and then the guy that had interviewed me, the CEO, had been sacked off immediately after my interview, so I just had parked that and thought, that's disappeared. And it's not something that I'm going to be getting involved in. Then got this phone call from the acting chief executive, Berlin Kafoa. And he just said, Bula Ben, explained who he was and said, look, he's got a press conference in 20 minutes. And I said, oh, that's great, Berlin. You know, what's it about? He said, it's to appoint you as the new head coach of the Fijian Sevens team. And so, yeah, so I went into one of those lanes and carried on the conversation. I said, look, have I got any say in any of this? And he said, yep, 20 minutes, call me back. So I think actually I mean, looking back at it, I'm pleased he only gave me 20 minutes, because if I had been given a day, I would have been very English about all of it. You know, got my book out, written my pros and cons, worked out. You know, I didn't know how much I was going to get paid, how long my contract was for, who my bosses were, what it'd be like to live. I'd never been to Fiji, who was left from the team. But I'd got really disillusioned in professional sport. I'd fallen out of love with the game. I was looking to do something else. And Fiji just kind of just came onto my horizon through a mate sending me a tweet saying they were looking for a new coach. And it kind of grew a little bit. And I knew I needed to do something different to find my why I do what I do. And so I said, okay, I'm in. And the journey kind of began from there.
So then you go back into the restaurant where your wife, Natalie, is sitting enjoying her meal. And you say, we're going to Fiji.
Well, I did allow her to have a little bit of a conversation around it at the time. And that's got nothing to do with the fact that she's now my ex-wife. But that night I was quite elated. It's exciting, right? You've suddenly taken up a job. And as a rugby coach, Fiji Sevens is one of those big ticket events. You know, you're thinking, this is going to be pretty cool. I'd played against Waisali Serevi and the Fijians. I'd coached against Fijians and the Fijian national team. And I could see that the potential they had. But then the following morning, you know, all of the reality kind of bit, I was getting messages from lots of people saying, oh, amazing, but did you know, they've got no money. It's a military dictatorship. They'll stone your house if you don't win a tournament. How much are you getting paid? They don't pay people, all these sort of things. And I suddenly wanted to get out of Dodge as soon as possible and rang my agent to see if I could get out of the deal. And he said, no, there's, you know, you'd lose too much face. It'd be too much bad news for you if you suddenly ducked out of it. You've got to go and see how you get on.
So you actually did want to pull out at that point after you heard those stories?
I was petrified in the morning. Okay. Yeah, I mean, my stomach was rolling around. And it wasn't even the stories. It was just the reality of moving everything to a new country for 3 years. And I didn't know, you know, I had no idea that what I was going to get salary. I didn't know any money in it, you know. And it turned out that I didn't get paid anything for 6 months.
Right.
But I think it was a really good lesson for me that when you've got a decision that you actually know is probably the right one, but you're worried about it, you're anxious about it, that it's not necessarily a bad thing to sit with that anxiousness and that anxiety and just still say yes. And luckily, I had a couple of people around me that said, look, you've got to go ahead with it. And I couldn't pull out. But I think if those sort of scenarios happen again, I'll be able to sit a little bit happier with those uncomfortable feelings.
So those first 6 months then, other than not getting paid, what were they like?
Well, it was very much a question when I got there that, you know, I didn't really want to make any big decisions. I wanted to understand the environment, the landscape, the people I was going to work with, and slowly sort of put some foundations in place. I was going into a Fijian rugby union that had just gone bankrupt, and World Rugby had also frozen any payments to them as they were investigating where the money was going. And it was a military dictatorship. And so Frank Bainimarama who was a military dictator at the time, was also president of the Fijian Rugby Union. You get given both posts if you're head of state. So he was my boss. And, you know, the players were coming in from the 355 different islands. You know, one of the star players had his legs cursed and couldn't stand up. And that was the first time black magic or white magic had come across my bow as a coach. You know, we didn't get too many excuses like that at Twickenham. And it was constantly like that, really. I was just getting new experiences of which I didn't really know the answers, but I wasn't going to step in and make any clear decisions on it until I had gained enough information around my culture. And then I kind of applied Pareto's law, really. I thought, look, what can I do that's not going to cost any money? And so that was get the boys really fit and get them training at an intensity they'd never had before. And I knew that if I could get them fit, then they would just be able to do what they do really well for longer. And that's kind of how it started.
And Fiji had some natural assets in that sense. All the sand. You became very familiar with sand dunes, didn't you?
Very familiar, yes, that's right. And it kind of came from, again, my dad, when he would tell me different stories about people. And one of them was Herb Elliott, who was the Australian middle distance runner in the 50s. And his coach, Percy Cerruti, was a big believer in taking people to beautiful areas to train, but then train them in a way where, you know, you almost can't do anything else. And he kind of pioneered the sand running. And I remembered that story. And we had the Singatoka sand dunes around the corner that is a World Heritage Site. You know, some of the dunes go up to 200 metres. You'd get there at 5 a.m. before the sun hits the sand and makes it too hot for your feet. The smoke's coming up from the villages below as they were all waking up. And you do this ridiculously hard training together, and it's almost a spiritual moment. It's unbelievable, with the Pacific on one side and the villages and the dunes on the other, and we would do that until they couldn't run anymore. And it was a really bonding experience that we used those natural assets.
And how difficult, Ben, was it to get those players who are, you know, it's a very different culture. They're not used to that level of professionalism that you had had with the England team and, you know, all their GPS fancy technology and the best nutrition and the video analysis and everything that comes with a high-end elite sport. How difficult was it to get those players to buy into those sort of training sessions?
Yeah, well, for the first 3 months, apart from Osea Klinisau, who I brought back into the team and made captain, he had been kind of ostracised by the Fiji Rugby Union. None of the rest of the players said anything to me. They just nodded their heads whenever I said anything. And so that was trying to break down those communication barriers at the start was really difficult, because they just saw a hierarchy and they were used to being told what to do by their coach, whether that was going on sentry duty through the middle of the night to get yourself tougher, which they had just done for the previous World Cup in Moscow, where the coaches then had gone home and sleeping in their own beds. The players were on sentry duty all through the night to toughen them up and then expected to train to a high level. And so I had to build up that relationship with the players. So I went to meet the families, I went to meet their friends, I went to their communities and their villages so that I could build up that trust between them. And then once I had their trust, a Fijian, when they like you and they trust you, you know, they'll do anything for you. And we got a very tight group very quickly.
So I really want to understand a bit more, Ben, about the circumstances that you found when you arrived. So just to get the timeline clear, when was that phone call in Richmond? When are we talking here?
That would have been about September 2013.
So 2013, and then your sort of first day in Fiji was when?
Oh, a week later.
A week later, so straight on the plane, straight out there. 6 months, you go September to the spring of 2014 without getting paid. Yeah. You've got black magic working on star players' legs. You're training on the sand dunes at 5 a.m. What about those sort of threats, those rumours that you heard about? Did any of that come to pass at all in those early months?
Yeah, well, I mean, my first meeting with Frank was actually on my second day. So Frank Bainimarama, you know, and I met him at a stadium where there was a tournament going on, and I sat down with him and next to his bodyguards, you know, and he said, Bola, and said, you're going to get a lot of advice whilst you're here in Fiji. Ignore it all unless it saves your life. I wasn't entirely sure which angle to take on that, whether that was a... I just smiled.
That's a real welcome to Fiji, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
But after that first tournament, and we'd crashed out in the quarterfinals, beaten heavily by England. I flew home and just put my plan together for the next 3 years. And as soon as then I turned around, basically, in a few days back to Fiji, I presented him with that plan and said, look, you know, if you let me do this, and you make sure that you only involve people that are involved and I don't get any curveballs from you, then we're going to have some success.
And the money gradually, one hopes, started to come in, did it?
Yeah.
Why weren't you paid for 6 months?
They literally didn't have any money.
There was no money. You're going into a zero budget operation.
Yeah, I was getting when we went away in that first, I think the second tournament, I didn't get anything in the first tournament. I think I got $100, so that's 30 quid. For a week, so times seven, so I think we got 200 quid for that first next tournament in Dubai, which we won actually. But
you're in the Olympic cycle at this time. You're in the Olympic cycle of the Olympic Games, where you end up winning the gold medal, and you've been paid about 200 quid for about 7 months' work. I mean, this is unbelievable.
But Ben, this wasn't only were you not being paid. You were actually spending your own money in that first 6 months, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, because there was bizarre things happening. You know, our team manager would go into the Fiji Rugby Union and go, look, we need some money for the bus because you've got no petrol in it. And they would just, you know, say to him, well, look, if it's God's way, you'll get to the training ground. And it's like, well, look, I'm sure God does some remarkable things, but as far as I know, if it says empty on the tank, it's probably not going to get us 100 miles. So you're paying for stuff like that. You're doing favours where you go to these tournaments that I'd been to for a long time to just get some help with getting some extra food or not having to pay for a gym or swimming. And I had a lot of love around that Fijian team from lots of people around the world at these tournaments that saw how nice they were, how well behaved they were, how they were going around in all had different t-shirts and wrong kit on, and they had a soft spot for us, and I eternally grateful for the wider game of rugby helping me in those first few months.
When you say well behaved, you did have to watch them though, your players, didn't you? They were, one or two of them were partial to a drop or two.
Yeah, I mean, look, in Fiji, the entire country's living in the present for today, and they don't even think about Mataka tomorrow. And so that's great in the game. You see it in the way they play rugby and the offloading and the risk and how that reflects their culture. But unfortunately, that can also be reflected if there's a free bar, you know, that they will not worry about what the consequences are. And the same for a buffet in the hotel. So I had to have some very clear black and white boundaries around that. And, you know, over those 3 years, we lost players that broke those rules, but for the greater good of the team.
Can you tell us what the worst example of that was?
Setting fire to a hotel room in London. That could have gone badly wrong. It was after we'd won our second World Series, and it was really hard to contain people coming from outside. We were staying at the hotel at Chelsea Football Club. And so lots of people from the Fijian community wanted to come and meet the players. We weren't flying out till quite late the following morning. And one of the players had managed to get out, have a few drinks. He'd gone back to his hotel and he just thought it'd be fun to set his curtains on fire and see what happened. I think that was the only time I ever had to pay for any sort of hotel costs for damage in my time as a coach. And yeah, you had to keep an eye on guys and give them clear boundaries. And occasionally they, you know, like we all know, sportsmen and women, like normal human beings, don't always stick to what they're told, and they've got to expect that there's consequences to their actions. And if I hadn't done that and I'd allowed too much grey in the programme, we'd have never got that consistency and we wouldn't have got anywhere near the podium.
This is Sport in the Fields, in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB, and we're in conversation with Ben Ryan. We're over the hump of this story now, and we'll fast forward to 2016 and the Rio de Janeiro Olympic Games. Ben arrives with his team from Fiji, but did he in his heart believe they would win the gold and fulfill their destiny?
Yes, I honestly thought that we had easily the fittest and most talented team there that were also had made the most sacrifices. We were the last group of athletes to go into the village, I think half an hour before they lock it down for the opening ceremony stuff. And I'd seen from previous Olympics, you know, how there's so many distractions around the Olympics and the village in particular, that it's not all Usain Bolts, and a lot of people are there for the experience, lose their first round, their first heat, their first game, and they're in Olympic tourist mode and party mode. So we took all our phones off us. We kind of just did everything very tight as a team. Had, I think, one or maybe even two training sessions before the tournament, and then off we went.
What was it like for you, though, in Rio? Because there was, I mean, you handled it brilliantly, actually, but there was a lot of pressure, a lot of expectation on you. And there were so many people that were so excited about watching Fiji, about the story, about the journey you'd been on. And, you know, there was a lot resting on your shoulders in those sort of 5 or 6 days.
There was. And I guess the one thing that I've taken from it afterwards is that, you know, your anxiety as a coach is massively reduced by how well you prepare beforehand. And we literally had left no stone unturned. I'd got them to the highest level of fitness they'd ever been. We'd got them battle hardened by the games we'd had before the tournament. The diet was ridiculous. They'd all come off sugars for 6 or 7 weeks, which at the start was unbelievably hard to get a Fijian off sugar. But by the end, they didn't want to go back on it because they could feel and see the benefits of it. And we'd done all our analysis on opposition. We knew exactly what game plans we were going to run against certain people. We had a specific game plan for the South African team that we never ended up playing, but we thought would be our major rivals in the tournament. And so you went in actually feeling pretty relaxed because they were running, they were aligned, and they were all almost running themselves.
I mean, one of my most surreal moments actually was watching a game of sevens at the Rio Olympics, describing how it all works to Hollywood A-lister Matthew McConaughey. Do you remember him? Do you remember him being here? I was like, you know, the guy, you know, the Lincoln lawyer and Dallas Buyers Club, him with that wonderful laconic Texan drawl. But his wife was Brazilian, and so she was quite a big star. So there was this power couple there, and they didn't know what to do with them because if they sat them in the stands, they just got mobbed. So they ended up putting them in near the broadcast area. So he comes wandering along, and he's just sort of at my shoulder, and I'm watching this whole game of rugby sevens with Matthew McConaughey. Did you meet him?
Yeah, I said hello because he was at the game when we played the US on, I think, the second day. He was kind of close to their dugout really during that game, so I saw it and realised who he was. And Buzz Aldrin was also in the crowd, and I met him as well after the game. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's all part of the Olympic Games, isn't it? You do occasionally have these moments where they're just surreal, but we were pretty focused, and we just got on with the job at hand, to be honest with you.
Do you think Buzz Aldrin became a fan of Fiji Sevens?
He honestly did. He loved it, and he was really into it, and he spoke really nicely to us afterwards. So I think rugby got itself quite a lot of new fans after that tournament.
Well, I suppose you could say one small step through the rounds, one giant leap to the gold medal.
So if we fast very forward, good, you know,
we're not, sorry, yeah, I can resist. You know, we're not here to talk about rucks and mauls and tries and penalties. Let's fast forward through the rounds. Let's fast forward to the gold medal match. I mean, it's on the line, Ben. Did you allow your mind to sort of cast itself back into history and the journey that you'd been on to that point?
Well, we'd gone through fairly well to the final, and we hadn't got any new injuries. We'd lost one player, but had him replaced by an amazing player in his reserve. And then we were just waiting for the final, really. And it was a very chilled hour and a half, 2 hours, where the boys were looking at a couple of the Great Britain games on the laptop. We were the only team not to have an analyst. it was another thing that by the end we could afford, but I just thought it was unneeded. You know, if you can't work out what's going wrong in a game of sevens that only lasts 14 minutes, then you're probably in the wrong job. And and so we had just done that. They'd eaten their little bits and bobs, and everything kind of flowed pretty well, even to the point where, you know, you finish the warm up and you go back into the changing rooms and you've got 5 minutes, just a little bit under, before they run out into the tunnel. And I had prepared my pre-match Olympic final speech to talk about some of the things you just talked about, you know, the first medals, the opportunity to be role models, set a legacy, all these sort of things, remind them of all the hard work they've done. And when I just went into the changing room and they were smiling, dancing, joking with each other, having little conversations, really positive, relaxed body language, I knew that if I said anything, it was only going to be for me. So I just said, have fun, and walked out. And really? And when they ran onto the field, I turned around and I saw them, and they literally looked like kids ready to go out and play with their mates at lunchtime in schoolyard. They, you know, as my captain would always say, if you're ever in a tunnel and against a Fijian team and they're smiling, you really better watch out. because you know, that is the ultimate combination to be, you know, they're relaxed but they're ruthless, and that's exactly what they did in the final.
So you ripped up the speech. You ripped up the team talk, basically.
Yeah. There was no need to do that. And, like, you know, I'm a big planner and I like to get plans, but it doesn't mean you always stick to them. And that was a classic example where less is more, and no point in over-egging something that was already perfect.
And there are moments, aren't there, where it just clicks. And they played the most sumptuous rugby sevens in that final. I mean, how important was it to you that not only did they achieve their destiny and they won the gold medal, but they did it in the manner that they did?
Yeah, that was what we wanted to do. And we had talked about that a lot, that we wanted to show, particularly in the biggest tournament any of us were involved in, exactly why Fiji kind of are associated with playing with flair and panache and risk and offloading and staying on our feet and creating space and not being prosaic and playing to numbers and set piece and all of those things. And the boys were 100% into that, you know. And I think the stats are ridiculous in the final. I think in 20 minutes, Great Britain made two tackles, you know, and attempted many, many more than that. But the boys just were on another level, really, in that final. And they wanted to play the exciting offloading game that you see in every village in Fiji. As you drive your car into the city or wherever, they'll all be playing before school. And I think, you know, that it was the right thing to do.
Tell us about the podium then. What's going on? What's happening inside, Ben?
Well, the boys had put on all their tracksuits. They'd gone onto the podium, and then Princess Anne had given them the first gold medal. And I can't remember who the first one was. It might have even been someone like Liani Nakarawa. He went down to kneel to take the medal. And that's in Fijian culture, that, you know, you get lower than the person that's given you the gift, and you clap your hands in a thombo, which is two cupped claps, and then say thank you. And Princess Anne luckily knew exactly, she hadn't been prepped, she knew exactly that that's how things work in the Pacific, and she gave the response, which is another cupped clap, and then the boys did it. And it kind of just reminded everybody that, you know, that they hadn't lost their identity as a culture and as a team, and they were still very humble in, you know, what was for them you know, the biggest thing that's happened to the game of rugby in Fiji.
It was such a lovely moment. I can remember standing on the side of the pitch, and we were on air at the time doing the coverage of the final and the commentary. And it was just, I don't know, it was just one of those moments where, you know, you little images that will stay with you forever when you've been fortunate enough to witness Olympic moments that really resonate. And it was just one of those moments where the players were kneeling and Princess Anne was putting the medals around their necks. And I think some people tried to sort of rewrite it, didn't they, Ben, and saying it was some sort of,
that's,
you know,
it.
Oh, it's some sort of colonialism, yeah. And, you know, sort of genuflecting. And you were just like, well, no, it was just a lovely moment.
Yeah, that's right. They do it to each other in the villages if they've, you know, been given a present or a gift. And that's exactly what it was. They just knelt in recognition of being given a gift, which was a gold medal. And that's kind of cool.
Definitely.
Well, you know, you talked about bars and buffets earlier, Ben. I bet there was a good one that night, wasn't there?
Well, weirdly, there wasn't.
No?
You know, I did all the press and then a couple of drug testing stuff for the boys, I didn't get back, I think, till well gone midnight. And I literally, as soon as my head hit the pillow, I had the best night's sleep. And some of the boys went off with Frank to his residence and they had a few drinks with him. Others, I banned them from McDonald's in the village. And, you know, it's a free McDonald's, which was, you know, for those boys, that is manna from heaven. It's ridiculous. And we'd walk past it on the way to get the coach to the games or training. And they'd just look at it and point at it and go, don't worry, you'll still be there after the tournament. And that was their real. So as soon as they finished, they shot off there, and they had as many, you know, Big Macs and fries as they could possibly have.
Well, it wasn't the carrot.
It was
the burger and fries at the end of the journey. It's like, there you go. That you're in there if you win us gold.
Yeah, it was almost as simple as that. And so that was that. And obviously, you know, when we got home to Fiji, things were slightly different.
It went mad. It was bonkers, wasn't it? The reaction you got in Fiji.
Yeah, totally bonkers. Kind of 3 days, I think, of bank holidays. We flew in and the airport had been shut down. And so that people would come on the tarmac to greet us. And then the bus took us to a local stadium that had 40,000 people in, and we had various things there. Then drove to the capital. No, flew to the capital because we'd driven the year before across, and it's only 2 hours, but it took us 9 because they were celebrating our world title and they'd put babies and kids in the road. So we had to stop at each of the villages to see everyone. So they flew us in a light aircraft for 20 minutes to the capital. And then the same thing happened. And then we got all given various awards and gifts and accolades. It was a pretty amazing time.
And you've got something in common with Her Majesty the Queen as well, haven't you? Because you're on a coin.
Yeah, coin notes. So they'd actually taken the Queen's face off most of the currency, and they decided that they were going to make a new $7 bill, first $7 in the world to celebrate the win. It's normal legal tender now, and also on every 50 cent piece my face is on the main side as well. So
so what was it like the first time you saw your face on a coin? That's so cool.
It was a few months later where I got a phone call from the mint. They rang me and said, look, this is what we're planning to do. I flew over to launch it with the captain Osea, and they showed me it all. And it was super cool. It's weird, and it shows you how much they love their rugby.
Yeah. Throughout this conversation, I'm sure everybody listening to it will have picked up on it, your respect for the Fijian culture, the way you immersed yourself in the local culture from minute one has shone through. How important was that to you, to really become almost Fijian, to tell this story the way it has been told?
It was vital, really, because what I didn't want to do was, I've seen it so many times where people come in from different cultures and then impose it or feel that they're better than the group they're coming into. And I could immediately see that if we were going to have all the successes that we did, I had to go into the culture, not the culture come to me. And so that's what happened. And we built on all those strengths, and I let the team do their speaking on the field. And we got very tight as a group. So, yeah, I couldn't have done it if I hadn't gone about it any other way.
You have a lasting memory of it in a tattoo, don't you? What does the tattoo say?
Yeah, I went to work in New York, and we have like lots of teams have their values and mission statements and things like that. We just had one, and it's called Velomani. And Velomani means work together, love each other. And it was what we framed all our conversations around. You know, if someone's late for training or someone's not doing what they should do, then it's against Velomani. And Velomani, if we got that right and we worked hard and for each other, then everything else would work out. So, yeah, it's a reminder when I'm on the district line and occasionally it's getting busy and I'm getting stressed, I can look at that tattoo on my forearm, on my wrist, and take a breath and go, look, just enjoy the present and be grateful for those of you, that are around you.
Brilliant.
Wonderful.
What an amazing story. What an amazing thing to have for the rest of your life, with most of your life still ahead of you. What is next for Ben Ryan?
I don't know, really. I'm enjoying like the portfolio of stuff I'm doing in lots of different sports. And I think when the next big challenge pops up, I'll know. And then I'll see if I can meet its standards.
There was one thing I want to ask. There was always talk of a movie that, you know, who would pay Ben Ryan? Damien Lewis was mentioned. Did that ever come to pass?
Yeah, it has. The script's been written now. Obviously, in Corona, they've had a bit of a suspension of everything. But once we get the green light, then they're going to start to get those wheels in motion. They've done the recce across to Fiji, and hopefully we can film there. And if not, we're going to have to go to New Zealand. But fingers crossed. We can go there and then that's something that I'm really excited about, and it's going to be a very cool story. They're using my relationship with Rapati, the manager, and the stuff we've just talked about, and the culture and that journey, plus the Fijian music and the landscape. It should make for a pretty colourful movie.
So are you going to be sort of almost like an executive consultant in that? Right? Don't tell us you're going to play yourself.
No. That's it. I think they call it executive producer, but that's just a fancy word for making sure no one's passing the ball forward.
So who is going to play you? Come on.
I can't.
Exclusive.
I can't, I'm afraid. I can't tell you that. So,
it's got to be David Lewis, surely.
You know,
I have an idea of who they're talking to at the moment. Yeah, so they're.
Does he have ginger hair?
Lots of people will say they don't have ginger hair. When you look at it, they've got a tint of it, whether it's russet or autumn sunset or terracotta. You know, some of the greats have had that colour barnet. So just wait and see.
Fantastic, yeah. Ben. Thanks so much. Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Top man. There you go, Ben Ryan. What a story, what a story he's just told and is going to have to tell over the course of his life. And there aren't too many genuinely great sports movies, are there? But I think this really should be good. Fantastic to hear that he is involved in the production. But who's going to play Ben Ryan? Form a queue. Come on, apply now. Who's it going to be, Sonia?
Oh, it has to be Damien Lewis. Yeah. He looks like him. He's got the red hair. He's got the freckles. Yeah. He's passionate about sport. He's the right age demographic. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a casting agent, it's not a difficult thought, is
true,
it?
True, but he wasn't giving anything away, was he? Straight bat from Ben Ryan there, I suppose we say, watch this space. Well, Sonia, you've seen a lot. You've been at Olympic Games since 1996. How does that Fiji achievement rank, and the story? Is it right up there with things you've seen?
No question. I have seen a lot, and you know, I'm passionate about rugby. So to see rugby so well received at that level, an Olympic level, and to see both men and women getting due credit for their brilliant ability, and for it to be topped off with such an outstanding performance from Fiji in the Olympic final, for them to finally achieve something tangible, to have that Olympic gold medal round their necks. I think, you know, you can talk about Fiji and how they perhaps struggle to break through at the top level, but in sevens they are the undisputed kings, and boy did they prove it.
Sonia, thank you very much indeed, and for telling that fantastic story, one of the great sports stories, I think, from the last few years. Make sure you subscribe if you've missed any of the episodes so far. They will be delivered to your podcast provider straight away. And don't forget, there's a new one for every day of what would have been Tokyo 2020. We'll see you next time on Sport and the Field.
Fields is a 94.19 independent production.
In association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB.